Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. I'm Chris Benda, Theological Librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with Jaco Hammon, Associate Professor of Religion, Psychology, and Culture, and Director of the Program in Theology and Practice, about his recent book, the second edition of Becoming a Pastor, Forming Self and Soul for Ministry. Jaco, thanks for being willing to do this interview.
Chris, I'm deeply honored. Thank you so much.
Yeah. What were some of your reasons for writing this book?
You know, Chris, I think I had like four reasons at the beginning. The one is that ministry leadership is such a challenging vocation. Research tells us that the lifetime of a minister today will be probably 14 years. That's the complete lifespan of a pastor. Wow. And in that time, they will probably transition between four and five times. So it's a real difficult, challenging vocation. And I wanted to see if I could help them, believing that without significant emotional and relational work and intelligences, that they just won't survive. So that was the one reason. The other reason is that the church is changing rapidly and is in decline. And I kind of ask myself, so what kind of leader does the church need to be relevant in today's world? So that was a question behind the book. A third reason was that I firmly believe that everybody who comes to a seminary or divinity school come for deeply personal reasons of transformation. It might be about identity, it might be about relationship or vocational discernment, but they actually come to be transformed. And I wanted to give images of what that transformation might look like. And then for about 10 years before I came to Vanderbilt, I taught a class that was called the pastor as person, looking at the sort of the emotional, psychological, relational foundations of pastors. And the book actually developed out of that class. So there's lots of references by students and from students in the book. Poems they wrote for this class, songs they wrote for the class, laments they wrote for this class. And it was fun to take the material of this class and actually turn it into a book form.
The title of the book, as I've said, is Becoming a Pastor, Forming Self and Soul for Ministry. And you write a bit about, at the beginning of the book, about what you mean by the word becoming. So what kinds of connotations does that word have in your book?
Yeah, I love to play with language, and I often look at origins of words, what we can learn from the words, believing that even though we may not use the word according to its original origin or intention, some of that lingers within the word. And so I use becoming in three ways. The one is that becoming speak of origins, beginnings. And I invite readers of the book to think about their origins, the relationships that formed them, the kind of a house they grew up in, the spiritual and religious formations that they had in childhood, for instance. I refer to that as like the first school of theology, where what did they get from that school? So it's tied to origins. A second meaning that I have for becoming is, that which is coming into existence, that we are always changing, we are always transforming. And I encourage people to think of becoming as a never-ending process. We will become even in the moment of death, and then some people will believe that we will become even after death. But you're always being shaped and transformed. And so the book is not written necessarily for people just entering into education and entering into religious leadership, but very seasoned people, I think, will find the book very helpful as well. And then the third connotation I have around becoming is that of, is it fitting or is it proper? And so I explore in the book many ways of appropriate kind of leadership, but then also those moments of inappropriate leadership, typically the ones we read about in newspaper headlines and things like that. But I think the moment you come and enter into religious leadership, you have to be fitting, you have to be proper. And what does that look like in today's world? So those are the three meanings that I explore around becoming.
Okay. You have already mentioned the whole issue of transformation, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about that. You're trying to help folks become transformational in their living and leadership. So what does it mean to be transformational, and why is that so important?
Yeah. So in my book, I try to work around a whole range of classic narratives out of the Judeo-Christian tradition. And one of those narratives would be the one that we know so well as the fall of humanity, you know, out of Genesis 2. And I argue that we can understand or read that text through at least three different lenses. The one lens we know well, that's the lens of sin and guilt. You know, Adam and Eve transgressed and they were punished. They were guilty because of that transgression. So that's one lens to use. But the meaning of the narrative changes radically if you use a second lens, which is the lens of shame, and you read it through the sense that they were naked and they went into hiding. Every person knows shame. And the language of guilt does not really speak to the language of shame. A third way of reading that narrative is reading it through the lens of seeking transformation. That the motivating factor for Eve was she wanted to gain knowledge. She wanted to be like God. And that dynamic is in all of us, that we seek experiences to be transformed in the way we think and feel about ourselves, or think and feel about other people, God, for instance. And so we all yearn and actively pursue, especially as adults, we actively pursue those moments of transformation. So I argue that pastoral leaders, religious leaders, should be conscious of the ways that they pursue transformation, or they will pursue it in ways that might not be helpful or even healthy. Mm. So that's the one argument I make. The other argument that I make is that no person in ministry or even in society will seek you out if you are a leader, if that person does not want to be transformed, if that person doesn't want to change. Now, of course, it's really difficult to imagine a person seeks a transformation if the entrance into the conversation is one of conflict, for instance, or one of disagreement or something like that. But I will argue every person that speaks to a pastor or a religious leader yearns for a much deeper transformation than what the surface conversation probably indicates.
Okay. This is the second edition of Becoming a Pastor, and among the differences from the first edition are an added chapter on generational differences, for example, the differences between or among the boomers and the Gen Xers and the millennials that we hear so much about these days. And also a greater recognition of alternative ministerial paths beyond what people frequently think when they think of the word pastor. Could you give an example or two of how generational differences and the calling to different kinds of ministry might play into a person's formation as a pastor?
Yeah, thank you. As the book was read by students and in the classes of colleagues as well, and even in my own class, Chris, we discovered that there's at least three generations in your classroom. You have millennials who will be the youngest in your class, you have Gen Xers, and then you have late boomers in your class as well, typically. And these three generations read the book so differently. The boomers were much more interested in matters of spirituality and nurturing their own spirituality. They were interested, for instance, in incorporating some formation they had from their previous vocations into the new one. Mm. And how do you do that well so that there is continuity with what they did? They were also asking a lot of questions about relational lives, either their own relational lives, which might have been made complicated by divorce and things like that, or how do you care for elderly parents while entering into the ministry? Those kind of questions they brought. The boomers also enter into more traditional mainline church settings, the more typical church that we think of. Gen Xers, they resonated mostly with the isolation and loneliness of ministry life, the independence that people have. And at the same time, they went into newer forms of ministry, what we would refer to as the emerging church or emergent church. They're the ones who buy the storefront and pitch a church right there. The millennials came yet with a different set of assumptions. They were really gravitating towards the pieces of the book that speaks about healing personal wounds and addressing the wounds you've received in life so that you do not become a walking wounded, as theologian Ed Wimberly will refer to pastors sometimes. But how do you heal? At the same time, they want to be shaped in a variety of ways that does not speak to church life necessarily, because they didn't envision themselves going into church life at all. We know from research from the business world that millennials today will probably have between 15 and 20 jobs, the average being about 3 years in a job. So how do you equip students who come for a Master's of Divinity degree or a Master's in Theological Studies, but they have to be shaped in so many ways beyond the very traditional church skills that we typically think of? So the generations come, they bring wonderful gifts of diversity, which is a real challenge if you're an educator, and a challenge if you want to help them grow and transform as individuals.
Yeah. Getting a little bit more into the book with this question, the bulk of the book is composed of chapters that call for the development of what you call capacities. And those capacities are, and I'm just going to list them, the listener will need to read the book to get some of the details. The capacity to believe, the capacity to imagine, the capacity for concern, the capacity to be alone, the capacity to use others and to be used, interesting phraseology, and the capacity to play. As you write in the book, the notion of capacity has kind of a spatial resonance. It has to do with the ability of holding things. I wonder if you could talk about that aspect of capacity and what you mean by that, what you're trying to convey with that.
Certainly. The capacities I address in the book are psychoanalytic constructs of human development. So all of us have these capacities in to one extent or the other. Let me just describe two of them briefly and why they might be important, and then I'll say something about Jesus, who I feel might give us a glimpse of this spatialness that you mentioned. So the capacity to believe is not about belief in something, but the capacity to believe speaks to having self-confidence that is not arrogant, to have an inner sense of security. And so I argue that clergy and religious leaders need to be self-confident in themselves, for imagine what might happen if you feel deeply insecure and you enter into moments of conflict or tension. Another capacity, the capacity to imagine, basically speaks to how can you be creative with the world of facts. Everybody has some capacity to imagine. But if your capacity to imagine is really poorly developed, just imagine what a sermon is going to look like. Or can you even imagine yourself into the shoes of someone else, which is the essence of empathy or care? So these capacities are really important for ministry skills and being a leader, so that you don't bore people to death or you basically are very ineffective at what you do. Now, the spatial quality of those are really true. So I'm thinking of Jesus. We look at Jesus, and he was able to welcome children, women, prostitutes, those who had leprosy, the marginalized. He could welcome them into his world and into his life Then we look at the Pharisees, and the only people they could welcome into their lives were the people that looked like them, thought like them, acted like them. And so there is a spatial quality in the sense that in my book I write about the inner space, which should be large and roomy, so that we can welcome all kinds of people into our world. And I'm thinking of, you know, Sunday is still one of the most segregated hours in American culture. Churches are fast to say everybody's welcome, but they really just want people like themselves. And I argue religious leaders are very similar. So we have to gain the capacity to welcome the stranger, which is the result of gaining these capacities that I write about. And when we do that, we do have an expansiveness to ourselves, which welcomes the stranger.
I think the capacities connect a little bit with this next question, which has to do with one of the resources that you use for the book quite heavily. You call on a number of resources in writing the book and in thinking about the concepts that you're discussing. But one of the most important is the work of someone named D.W. Winnicott. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about who Winnicott was and why his research, his writing, even his life is so fruitful for what you're doing.
Yeah. D.W. Winnicott has been my closest conversation partner as an academic. He was a British psychoanalyst and pediatrician. He was born in 1896. He died in 1971. But he is relatively unknown here in the States. And I'm sort of making it part of my mission to tell people about Winnicott as a wonderful, wonderful conversation partner. Winnicott is a post-Freudian, so his school of thought developed after Freud in two major ways that would be different from Freud's. The one is where Freud would see religion as an illusion that you have to grow out of, Winnicott actually saw religion as one of those places where you can live creatively, and that a mature, healthy individual will partake in something like religion or something very cultural. So I really appreciated that. The other big difference between Winnicott and Freud is that where Freud saw us being basically driven by inner instincts that is conflictually present in our lives, Winnicott saw us as having been created to seek relationship, which I think fits very closely with the Judeo-Christian worldview, that we were created to seek not only relationships on the sort of the horizontal level with other people, but we were also created to seek relationship with God. So he's a wonderful individual to work with if you are in religion as well. He called himself an amateur theologian. He met weekly with a group of clergy for many years. And one of the things he would say to a person that if you meet with somebody and the person still intrigues you, you can be of service to that person. But the moment the person bore you, or the moment you say, oh, not that call again, the moment you say that, then that's probably the moment to refer to someone else. Just a wonderful individual to work with. I also appreciate the fact that Winnicott had a radio show for many, many years where he tried to bring psychoanalytic concepts, which can be esoteric and challenging at times, but he tried to bring that to the everyday sort of population. And he worked extremely hard on changing the lives of families. And I resonate with that in a sense, becoming a pastor is a book everybody can read. Even if you do not enter into ministry, I'm convinced it will be helpful to you. Because I kind of try to write it in that same mode of, can we bring very academic, clinical concepts, but make it applicable to everyday life.
Right. Now, getting back a moment to the capacity issue or capacity chapters of the book, you end each of the chapters in the book with suggestions on cultivating the particular capacities. And you use an acronym to organize the suggestions that you make for cultivating capacities. The acronym is GRASP: God, Relationships, Action, Scripture, and Prayer. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what each of these elements is. And I was curious if GRASP is just sort of a fortuitous acronym, or if there's something about grasping that you're actually trying to use in this.
And it's definitely both. Okay. It's definitely both. I discovered early in my career as a teacher that unless you can help people understand God differently, you don't really help them, because in times of crisis, they will revert back to the God that they discovered early in life. It ties to the origins that I've mentioned earlier. And so when I ask people to reflect on God, I ask them to discover something new about God, or I try to show them on a piece of scripture that may challenge a very traditional understanding of God, just so that they can grow in how they engage the divine. Relationships would be the same. I invite people to think not only of the relationships that form them, but I think in terms of what relationships can they identify that will help them grow, that will transform them. For instance, on the chapter to play, I ask them, so who might be a playful individual that they know, and how might life and ministry change for them if they spend more time with that individual? So the relationship takes them back into history, but it also sort of encourages them to find really transformational relationships who can help them grow. And that might be a counselor or a spiritual director or just somebody who's really wonderful at inviting newness out of a person. The actions are very similar. I invite people to do something differently. And to do something differently then to help them understand themselves better, or to put themselves in a position that's very uncomfortable and that they should ask, why is this uncomfortable? But actions that will broaden their world, that will create that spaciousness that we mentioned earlier. Scripture would be exactly the same. And I end with prayer, because prayer is such a life-giving ritual. And I invite folk to begin to pray sort of more consciously for certain things in their own lives and in the lives of others, so that the prayer supports and encourages the kind of transformation that we are longing for. And so GRASP, yes, I mean, it's an acronym that I sort of created. But at the same time, I think that if you understand what becoming is all about, it's probably impossible not to think God must be involved somehow, relationships must be involved somehow, and these other components that we've mentioned. So if you grasp the book, you probably will engage some of these things just naturally.
Right. Okay. We don't have time to look at every chapter in the book. That's something that the reader can do. And you've already kind of mentioned a couple of the chapters. I did want you to talk at a little bit of length about the chapter on the capacity to play, simply because you've spent a lot of time thinking about play. You've written a book about playing. With a lot of these capacities, when you look at the word believe, you have certain imagination about what that means, and you see that with some of the other other terms that you use. Play, I mean, that brings up certain visions in people's minds. What do you mean by play, and why is it so important? I mean, this chapter is the last chapter. It's sort of the culminating chapter, capacity chapter. Why is play so important for ministers?
Play is the most transformative experience that we can engage in on a regular basis that costs absolutely nothing. It is a wonderful experience to have. It's also one of the very few experiences that just about every person knows intimately, because everybody played at some point in our lives. So play is important because it teaches us how to get along with strangers and others. It teaches us how to hold back our aggression, for instance. You know, when we were young, we kind of sparred and jostled and stuff like that. And if we didn't hold back our aggression, the game would be over because one of us would be crying soon. And that's the end of our game. But it also teaches us around problem solving. It teaches us how to hold back affect and emotion. It teaches us so many things. And research shows that for most people around the age of 12, play begin to diminish greatly in their lives. And we are introduced to dichotomies such as work and play, and work is more important than play. And I want to show people that playing is not something you do, but playing is a way of being. It's a way of living. And so you can be playful in every moment, even in death. You can be playful in so, so many ways. And I am writing about play as sort of the culmination of the book because most pastors were so mature for their age. When they were 6 years of age, they were going as if they were 8 or 9. And family and friends and others would say, oh, you know, Jaco is so mature for his age, as if that's a huge compliment. But it is actually one of the saddest comments, because what it means is that you've accepted emotional responsibility way beyond your years. And the part of the cost of that is that you have given up on play. So a pastor comes and meets with a parishioner who believes something. Let's just take the example of, you know, our family ran into financial hardship because God is punishing me for what I did as a teenager. And that's the parishioner's world, where the parishioner lives. And so the parishioner actually gives the pastor all these toys to play with. But now the pastor doesn't know how to play with those toys. And the pastor interprets this as, boy, that is just bad theology. Let me give you good theology. And will pull up some knowledge that he or she got in a systematics class or somewhere else, and try to counter that belief with another belief, rather than exploring and engaging the parishioner as if the parishioner offered toys to play with. Pastors can only play typically with the toys that they give. And our parishioners and other people give us so many things that we can play with. They invite us into this game. And pastors don't know how to play this game. And so I encourage folk then to cultivate play in their lives, irrespective of their age. Now, the other capacities in the book all speak to play. Play brings a lot of tension to our being. So this pastor, for instance, who just heard some real bad theology, you have to hold that tension. If you don't hold the tension, you try to squash the tension by speaking some other truth into the person's life. So that speaks to the capacity of belief, being secure enough to hold the tension. If you are not imaginative, you don't play well. The capacity of object usage, which is difficult language that Winnicott gave us, but it basically speaks to how do I discover the other person as a unique individual. In the language of Martin Buber, how do I discover the other person as a thou and not an it? If you don't have that well-developed capacity inside of yourself, it impacts how you view every parishioner that you encounter. So play is foundational to living, but at the same time, it encourages us to look at these other aspects of our lives, for if we don't, we won't be able to play, even if we want to. And we know, for instance, that the burnout rate of clergy is much higher than other vocations like nursing, which is also a helping discipline of some kind. And I think the reason is that clergy do not know how to sort of engage people effectively on average, and so they get overly involved in lives of others, which becomes a burden. They can't sustain themselves down the road. But play is the most transformative experience we can have. And if we can encourage a playful attitude, suddenly worship becomes a group of strangers playing together. Communion becomes playing with food. Prayer becomes, how do I play with God? And so baptism becomes playing with water. What does it mean to play with water? All scriptural themes that can be developed. But you have to be somewhat playful to say that communion is actually playing with food, something we all did at some point in our lives.
You've already mentioned I hesitate to call it a dichotomy because it doesn't turn out to be a dichotomy exactly, but I'll say the dichotomy between being and doing. And you said, you use that in your discussion of play. At one point in the book, you, in a section called The Violence in Overfunctioning, and that title kind of gives you a sense that perhaps overfunctioning is a problem. You write that in overfunctioning, doing in ministry overrides being a facilitative presence. So in that case, it's probably better to be being than doing. But and then another point in the book, you note that developing these capacities that you're talking about requires a person to do, not just be. So how do you describe, in this last question, how do you describe this relationship between being and doing? And I was just sort of playfully wondering whether knowing when to be and to do is another capacity we might need to develop.
well said. So Winnicott is often referred to as the master of paradox, and he always worked with paradoxes. One would be being and doing. Another one would be between subjectivity and objectivity, and illusion and fantasy. He had all these tensions that he introduced. And so Winnicott said that all doing originates in being, by which he meant that whatever actions we take or are engaged in, it's birthed within the inner worlds that you and I have. And so in my book, I try to argue that if we get to know our inner worlds well enough, if we know what to make us anxious and not anxious, for instance, then that can help us to be more of a facilitative presence in the lives of other people. The violence of overfunctioning speaks to the fact that if I feel anxious about something, I am more likely to act without thinking what my actions might be. A pastor who grew up, for instance, in a house with significant financial hardship now meets this family at church who also has financial hardship. And within seconds, the pastor has worked out a budget for the family, you know, how they can sort of make all their how they can pay all their bills and make their responsibilities count for them. But the family doesn't learn anything in the process. A pastor who doesn't know how to grieve and mourn will become so uncomfortable around death and grieving and lamenting, and the pastor will say, oh, but I want to be so happy that the person is in a good place right now, you know. No more pain, no more tears, which kind of discourages the person to actually grieve and mourn and cry. So over-functioning is doing the emotional and spiritual and relational and economic work for another person. And in the process, the person does not grow, which I say is a violent act. If we keep people from growing and learning, it's an act of violence. And so doing and being is so sort of intricately related. We cannot separate them. They always go back and forth. And so, yes, I ask people to do certain things, like go and seek somebody whose imagination is more developed than yours, or read that novel who was written with an imagination more powerful than yours, so that you can be transformed. Doing and being closely connected. We cannot have the one without the other.
Jaco, thank you again for this conversation.
You're welcome. Thank you. I really appreciate the chance to share something about becoming a pastor.
Great. Again, I've been talking with Jaco Hammann, Associate Professor of Religion, Psychology, and Culture, and Director of the Program in Theology and Practice, about his recent book, the second edition of Becoming a Pastor, Forming Self and Soul for Ministry, published by the Pilgrim Press. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.